Pushkin.
Hello, Tim Harford here. Cautionary Tales will be back with two suitably spooky new episodes in time for Halloween. But in the meantime, I want to introduce you to a new show from one of my colleagues at Pushkin Industries. It's called Bad Women, The Ripper Retold. It's about a brutal series of murders in London in the 1880s, murders attributed to a killer known only as Jack the Ripper. You probably think you know the story already, but the reason I think fans of Cautionary Tales will appreciate this new show is that it seems we've all been misled up until now. The real story is far more interesting than the myth and contains plenty of lessons that are still relevant today. The show's host is the historian Hallie Rubenhold. Hallie, we've got the story of Jack the Ripper all wrong, you say. Explain.
Yes, we have. For a very long time, we've relied really on the Victorian telling of this story. And the story goes something like this. Jack the Ripper in 1888, a serial killer whose identity was never discovered, killed five women, perhaps more, in Whitechapel, the East End of London. These women were all prostitutes, they were out soliciting at the time, and he murdered all of them and then managed to get away. This is pretty much what everybody knows about Jack the Ripper, and hunting for his identity has become a type of parlor game over the years. And we've never really stopped to consider who the victims were. And when we consider who the victims were and we look at their life stories, we get a completely different view of the Jack the Ripper story. And when we look at the history behind it, we can really pull apart the mythology and see the truth.
How was it that you became interested in this story?
I'm a social historian. I'm a historian of prostitution, of women's lives, of the underclass, of the underworld. And I had written a book, The Covent Garden Ladies, which went on to become Harlots on television. And I was looking for something which kind of followed on from this exploration of 18th century prostitution and giving names and identities to the women who practiced this profession. And I thought, well, who are the most famous Victorian or 19th century sex workers? And I thought, automatically, I thought, oh, that will be the victims of Jack the Ripper.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, nobody's written about this. This is extraordinary.
I mean, we should say, endless books have been written about Jack the Ripper, just not about the women.
Endless books have been written about Jack the Ripper. Forests have been felled in the pursuit of writing books about Jack the Ripper. And yet, when I started my research, there was one very small, almost kind of pamphlet written about the women. And looking at them separately from Jack the Ripper was really quite a novel idea, because in the past, the way we tell their stories is that they are simply stepping stones to figuring out who Jack the Ripper's identity was. It was almost as if their deaths created him.
But then when you looked into their lives, what were you able to find out?
I was able to reconstruct them as people, to see who they were, what their beginnings were, what their contexts were. And contexts are so important for historians. I think we have this notion that facts are kind of freestanding. Facts are facts. But facts change when you set them in different contexts. And suddenly, a lot of things which you think were facts actually aren't facts at all. I work very specifically from documents and documentation, and I cross-reference things with other documents. And a lot of the Jack the Ripper story comes from newspapers. But underneath that, there's a whole level of things like censuses and social housing ledgers and church records and things like this, which will give you a better sense of what really happened. And they're much more reliable sets of data than newspaper reports, which, you know, you can cross-reference with.
You're not telling me that newspapers are occasionally unreliable?
Oh, newspapers? No, of course not.
I'm quite struck. One of the, I don't want to deliver any spoilers, but one of the cautionary tales I'm working on for Halloween is about the obsession with the curse of the pharaohs. And it turns out that a lot of these stories turn out to be entirely confections of newspapers. A historian of this describes it as newspapers reporting hearsay about hearsay. And when you actually dig down, there's nothing there.
You know, we tend to think that fake news is a new phenomenon. And fake news is, it has been with us since the advent of newspapers. And the Victorians were very good at creating fake news. People like stories. And in the 19th century, it was very difficult to fact check things. And a lot of newspapers were syndicated. And editors would just cut and paste, literally cut and paste.
Old school.
Exactly.
Scissors.
Exactly. Scissors and paste, and cut out quite significant parts and add in other things and embellish. And this became enshrined as fact.
Okay, but it's not a fact. And you've been trying to get more reliable records. I mean, I can't imagine there's that much there, but there must be, what, police records, court records? What did you find?
The most useful set of documents are the coroner's inquests. Coroner's inquests happen in the absence of an actual trial, when they had to ascertain the cause of death, and they had to kind of figure out what happened and piece everything together so they could sign off on the death certificate. And so these really are the most important documents there are. Well, amazingly, and I didn't realize this until I started working on this, for three of the five women, these coroner's inquest documents are gone. Yeah. So all of the witness reports, everything we have, has come to us from newspapers. And you look at 10 different newspapers and you get 10 different versions of what a witness said. So what actually happened? We don't know.
You described yourself as a historian of, among other things, prostitution, of sex work. These women are often described as prostitutes. I took that for granted. But listening to the early episodes of the podcast, it turns out it's a bit more complicated than that.
Well, first of all, there is no proof that three of the five women were ever involved in sex work. Two were, and there is a long trail of evidence, and that's in court records, in police records, and this is how I came to my conclusions. When there are no records, when there is no bedrock of reliable historical documentation, when there is hearsay, we cannot make a judgment about what somebody was doing. Not only that, but we have to understand the complexities of what was being said in the Victorian era and how women were viewed and how women of certain classes were viewed. These women were considered defective women because, for the most part, they had no homes, they had no families, they didn't have a man to look after them. They were separated from their children, and a lot of them were reliant upon alcohol and spent a lot of time on the street because you didn't necessarily live your whole life inside the lodging house. And if you were out on the street in the slums, at night, in the pubs, the assumption was that you were a prostitute.
But that assumption is not necessarily true at all.
The assumption is not true. And certainly we cannot make an absolute judgment about what somebody was doing, certainly if we don't have hard documentary evidence.
Now, I'm curious. Sex work is stigmatized even today. I'm assuming it was more stigmatized in the late 19th century. Is that right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Not only that, but, you know, the label of prostitute, I mean, this is a very flexible thing. You know, a woman who lived with a man outside of wedlock was considered a prostitute.
Yeah.
You know, a very good measure of this, in fact, is if you look at, there were a number of reformatory homes that women went into if they wanted to turn their backs on their lives of sin, okay? And these homes, Magdalene hospitals, as they were often called, or Magdalene houses, were open to women who had worked as sex workers, women who had even lived out of wedlock with a man, and also victims of incest. So that gives you an idea of how ready society was to lump all of these women together as being sexually tainted. If you're sexually tainted, you have knowledge of sex outside of marriage. If you have knowledge of sex outside of marriage, if you're separated from your husband and you shack up with another man, you're an adulteress.
Yeah.
You're a whore. So this is what Victorian society thinks of these women.
And is that that sort of stigma, applying this label, is that an important part of the Ripper myth?
Yes, it is. It's a cautionary tale, isn't it?
I suppose it is.
It is. It's a Victorian cautionary tale because this is the story which is told to women, and the Victorians said, well, look at these women. They're broken women. They're out on the street at night. They're living in the worst part of town. They're separated from their husbands. And they're killed by this terrible, terrible man in a terrible, terrible way. And this goes to show you, ladies, what you shouldn't do in life. Make sure you tread a moral course.
Yeah. So not saying that they deserved it, but the myth suggests that they could have prevented it if they had lived a wiser life. That is the way the tale is framed.
It's about their moral failings. And I think this is something even today, our society still, you know, people on the margins, homeless people, drug addicts, alcoholics, sex workers are killed, and our society turns a blind eye and they think, well, you know, what do you expect? This is what happens. And so that's our society's way of reinforcing our values, unfortunately.
One of the cautionary tales that I told last season was about a very different serial killer, Harold Shipman, who was a doctor who murdered his patients. And for a very long time, people didn't even realize crimes were being committed. The patients were thought to have died of natural causes. So clearly very different from the furore around Jack the Ripper and all the excitement about these very violent murders. But although there are differences, there does seem to be a very interesting parallel, which is that the victims were put in a sort of box. Assumptions were made about them because of the kind of person that they were assumed to be, that they were said to be. In the case of the Ripper, these women were assumed to be prostitutes, and that carried certain implications. In the case of Shipman, they're all old people. And, you know, what do you expect from old people? Old people die, of course. If a statistician had really taken a look, he or she would have very quickly said, well, they're not that old and they shouldn't die that often and there's something strange going on. But people didn't look at the numbers. And the psychological term for this is the representative heuristic. An old person dies, people go, yeah, that sounds like the kind of thing that would happen. And I wonder whether the same sort of lesson applies to the case of the women who were killed by the Ripper.
To some degree, yes, I think people expect those living on the margins to be murdered. They expect that to happen. It is expected, it was expected in the Victorian era, that if a woman leaves behind her family, her husband, doesn't have a roof over her head, lives in the worst part of town, is poor, drinks, that yes, her life of sin will end in a terrible death.
Did that delay investigation?
I think it would have misdirected the investigation, as is the case with a number of murders. And in our show, we talk about, for example, the serial killer Samuel Little in the United States, whose crimes were overlooked for decades because he was killing the same sorts of women that Jack the Ripper killed in 19th century London.
I'm also intrigued by the way that we tend to get stuck with particular views of the world. One of the first cautionary tales I told, perhaps the very first one actually, was about an oil tanker running aground in broad daylight, in good weather. And it was because the captain made a plan and wasn't able to readjust his thinking. And you describe in the podcast this whole subculture of ripperology. And it's a little different, but people do seem to be very set in their assumptions. And there are certain kinds of things that you're allowed to do. Like you can come up with a cool new idea for who the Ripper might have been, but other things that you're not allowed to do. Like you're not allowed to make too much fuss about the women, for example. And you get pushback if you do ask those questions.
Yes, you do, because you are basically challenging the orthodoxy. And the orthodoxy is an interesting thing, because generally ripperologists, you know, those who study Jack the Ripper, sometimes obsessively, don't agree on anything. You know, they all have different ideas about who the killer was and the method of killing and various things like that. But the one thing they all do agree on, it's like the keystone, the cornerstone to ripperology, is that these women were all prostitutes. It's the one thing that is an unmovable in this. And I came along and I was an outsider. And I said, well, actually, if you look at this, there's no hard evidence of this. There's absolutely no proof at all. I don't know where you get this. I went absolutely berserk, crazy, because I was challenging this orthodoxy, this canon. And if you kick out that stool from under Ripperology, it all comes down because you start questioning the evidence upon which everything is based. And then you realize there is no pursuit, there is no study of Jack the Ripper because we have nothing really to go on here.
And you've described the way that these women were isolated, were vulnerable, living this very marginal existence. What does that tell us about the late Victorian economy and late Victorian society? Forgive me, as an economist, I've got to ask about the economic impact. But it seems that this is actually partly a story about economics. It's partly a story about poverty.
Yeah, it is. And in fact, I think you might find this interesting as an economist. It's one of the things that I really explored and really learned about in the course of doing this is, first of all, everybody assumes that if a woman is poor in the slums, if a woman has nothing left to sell or to do, she sells herself. Now, this isn't necessarily the case because a woman, you know, has a number of other options. And this assumption that, well, this is how a woman slides into prostitution. First of all, a woman has a certain economic value in her body. She has sexual capital. And the older she gets and the sicker she gets, the more that capital diminishes. And so how much she can possibly earn from that is questionable. But not only that, but as I was exploring this world, I learned about something which I called the economy of the slum and others call the economy of makeshift, which is how did these very, very poor people survive? And there were all of these ways of borrowing and begging money from the poorest members within society. So, for example, if you needed 4 pence for your lodging house bed, and a lodging house bed cost 4 pennies for a single, and you had 2 pennies, before the lodging house deputy keeper came round for the evening to collect everybody's money, you could go around the communal kitchen, which every lodging house had, and you tap up your friends. And you say, well, look, mate, you know, I stood you a beer last week and, you know, he can spare a half penny. And then you go around to somebody else and say, well, look, you know, I shared my baked potato with you. What's that worth to you? Well, I can give you a penny. And then you try to make up that. And then maybe you can get some credit from the lodging house keeper because you're a regular there. And then you may owe a half penny. And then you get your bed for the night. And then it starts all over the next day. And people are constantly sharing and begging. They may only have a couple of pennies, but somehow they help each other. And there's pawning as well. People are constantly pawning things. They take off their shoes. They pawn their shoes in exchange for tea and bread. They sell coats, sell jackets. There are stories of women who, at the time when crinolines were fashionable, would step out of their hoops and take it to a pawn shop and just sell it and get the money right there and then. And so things were constantly negotiable. There was always some way of earning a penny, and it was hand to mouth, and it was hour to hour living.
I love hearing this idea of the slum economy. Just as an economics nerd, it's fascinating. But I'm curious. So you've described this risk sharing between people, where someone hasn't got enough, someone's got a little extra, and you know, it all evens out. But there must be money flowing into the slum economy somehow from somewhere. So is that factory work? Is that begging? Is that prostitution? Where's the money coming from?
It's everything. It's labor.
Yeah.
You know, people are working and they're working in menial jobs. A lot of women worked as charwomen. They worked as...
And what is a charwoman?
Oh, yes, of course. I have to explain. Charwomen were basically day servants, and usually they were the lowest of the low. And they were... I mean, the interesting thing is they may have been paid a couple of pence for what they did. But one of the perks was that they were given leftover food. And so that's great. So that defrayed their need to buy food. You also could work in a factory, and there were a number of factories. You could do piecework at home, which was absolutely grueling and awful. So, for example, you would be given a pile of matchboxes that you had to assemble and all the glue and everything. And you would have to make a matchbox every 20 seconds all day long.
Yeah.
There's even a story about a con artist.
Oh, I love a good story about a con artist. And I know Cautionary Tales listeners do. So go on. Don't tease me. Tell me about it.
Well, Elizabeth Stride came up with a way of making money. I mean, she was...
She's one of the women who was killed by the Ripper.
Elizabeth Stride was the third victim of Jack the Ripper.
Yeah.
And she came up with a way of making money, which was very ingenious. And a lot of people were doing this. There were a lot of begging scams at the time. And Elizabeth Stride claimed to have been on board the Princess Alice. Now, Princess Alice was a steamship that went down on the Thames in a terrible accident in the 1870s. And she said that she survived this. And she went around telling people that she was a survivor of this terrible. Hundreds of people died. This was the biggest maritime accident prior to the Titanic. And she made money out of this. She told people that this elaborate story that she had something like 9 children and that her husband died and that she was climbing up one of the funnels and somebody kicked her in her mouth and all these terrible things happened and then she was able to get money from people. But that was, you know, that was one of many schemes that she had. She also borrowed a baby and said that this baby was hers. A lot of women use babies in order to get money out of people to elicit pity. And then she tricked this woman called Mary Malcolm into believing that she was her long-lost sister. And for years, she was able to get money off of her every single week.
It's incredible. I'm curious as to how you borrow a baby. Is that like you're offering free babysitting service or that what's the...
Well, you have to think that a lot of women would go to work in places like factories and sweatshops, and they needed somebody to look after their children. And obviously, daycare didn't exist. There was a whole industry in baby farming where you basically drop your baby off with a woman who may or may not look after it.
Yes, or may lend it to this amazing con artist, Stride.
Yeah, exactly.
Thank you very much, Hallie. As you can tell from this conversation, the podcast is fantastic. It's vivid, full of surprising detail, completely blows apart the myth of Jack the Ripper. And the podcast is called Bad Women, The Ripper Retold. It's available now. Well, you know the usual places, wherever you get your podcast, wherever you're listening to this, please click and subscribe right away. And as a special treat, here is a taster of what's in store. Here is an episode from Bad Women, The Ripper Retold, hosted by Hallie Rubenhold.
A woman lies motionless. A passerby mistakes her for a vagrant. People often curl up in the hallways of this building at night. He ignores her. Another 2 hours pass before anyone realizes that the sleeping figure is in fact dead. And not dead from illness or mishap. She's been stabbed multiple times. Her clothing has also been pushed up, exposing the lower half of her body. Local residents claim they saw and heard nothing of her murder in the night. But perhaps they simply heard nothing out of the ordinary. After all, the neighborhood of Whitechapel, this patch of London's East End, has a reputation as a sink of misery and vice. A place feared and reviled by many richer Londoners. A byword for all that is wrong with modern society. It is no stranger to violence and murder. And soon, it will become synonymous with the deeds of a serial killer. I'm Hallie Rubenhold. You're listening to Bad Women, The Ripper Retold, a series about the real lives of the women killed by Jack the Ripper and how we got their stories so wrong.
One side money, plenty, and friends too, by the score. Then fortune smiled upon me, and no one passed my door. Now I'm poor and lonely, and not worth half a crown. No one seems
order to tell you these victims' stories, I first need to acquaint you with the spaces where they spent their final months, days, and hours in London's East End. Listen. This is the sound of 1888. It's a piece of music called The Lost Chord, recorded in the summer of that year on a phonograph, a marvellous new invention of the era. We are in London, and the date is August 6th. This is the capital of one of the richest, most technologically advanced superpowers on the face of the earth. It's also at the centre of the largest empire in history, with colonies, conquests, and dominions spanning a quarter of the globe, from Canada to the Cape, Egypt to Australia. Queen Victoria has been sitting on the throne for more than 50 years, reigning over this centre of art, literature, commerce, and science. She has recently celebrated her Golden Jubilee with a series of lavish balls, magnificent festivals, dinners, regattas, races, and parades designed to display the extraordinary wealth of the nation. But for all the splendour, there remains squalor.
Hold him down and take his money.
Pits and pockets of absolute destitution, like here. I've brought you to the heart of Whitechapel. This is Jack the Ripper's London.
Knock him harder.
A sailor from the busy docks nearby has wandered,
help!
Or perhaps been lured,
Police!
Into the dense maze of alleyways and dark courtyards.
Go on, get him!
He'll be beaten and left for dead. Whitechapel is one of the most densely populated parts of the city. Dozens of people will have heard the sailor's cries for help, but no one lifts a finger.
Well, we ain't deaf. But there ain't a night passes, there ain't a fight in a passage or a drunken row. But why should I interfere? It ain't no business of mine.
Let's walk along this street. It's called George Yard. It's not the sort of place for the unwary to wander. Even the local police agree. They consider George Yard to be one of the most dangerous streets in the locality. It is said that police constables dare not even enter the buildings around us. Crime has been decreasing across London as living standards have improved, but not here. In these tight, crowded streets, grinding poverty persists. I can tell you this with some certainty, because the written records are as rich as they are sobering. One eminent businessman, Charles Booth, set about documenting the true extent of poverty in the city. He sent his researchers to visit these streets and assess the inhabitants. They marked the findings down on a map, color-coding what they had witnessed. Look on those maps, and this neighborhood is bordered by streets of red, pink, and purple. The middle class, the well-to-do, and the comfortably off. But closer to us, those purples darken to blue, denoting the poor and very poor, people in chronic want. Where we stand, in George Yard, the map shows stretches of jet black. In the legend of the Booth maps, black stands for the lowest class. Vicious, it reads, and semi-criminal. The houses here are tall, dark, and old. Their brickwork is worn and covered in soot. Their plaster and paint cracks and crumbles. Many of the windows are broken. Indeed, these buildings are so shabby and neglected, they look like they must be abandoned. But they're not. The decrepit rooms inside have been portioned out to a multitude of different occupants. Entire families are crammed into these tiny living spaces, along with a variety of vermin, which make life itchy and disease-ridden. There's a shared toilet, a grim common privy. But many residents avoid this if they can help it, especially at night. Instead, they use a chamber pot stowed under the bed, so the stench in each room is heavy. I want you to meet the people who live here, people like Elizabeth Stride. She's currently renting a sparsely furnished room in one of these buildings with her hard-drinking, violent partner.
You stupid little woman.
Michael Kidney.
Get me my drink.
Elizabeth is resourceful, intelligent, and brave. She was born in rural Sweden and has taught herself to speak English fluently. Her life has been varied, at times filled with passion, but also marked by terrible misfortune. Her 44 years of life are fascinating, touching, and thought-provoking, but she will be remembered merely as the third victim of Jack the Ripper. Elizabeth and Michael Kidney's room is grim and desolate, but it does offer one significant advantage over other types of accommodation: a door that can be shut. At the alternative, a common lodging house, all space is shared and privacy is non-existent. This is where we're heading next. Just over there, on Thrall Street, is Wilmot's, a women-only lodging house. Polly Nichols, another Ripper victim, is staying there at the moment. She's been sleeping rough across London, and she's only just arrived in Whitechapel. Polly feels safer at Wilmot's than at lodging houses that accommodate both sexes. Lodging house life can be violent and unpredictable for a woman on her own. Polly is heavy-set, but small in stature, and her father has always thought she looked young for her age, even at 43. Polly's relationships with her family fascinate me. She was certainly a daddy's girl, but even he couldn't fix the mess that resulted when she walked out on her husband and children, never to return. For a Victorian wife and mother, this is extraordinarily bold, almost unheard of. What motivated her? Why would she do such a thing? But we'll return to Polly Nichols in a later episode. For now, we're on our way to another lodging house altogether, via a local market.
Butter cakes, cinnamon and biscuits, fried treacle fish. Jumbles, bowlers and jam.
These streets are a hive of activity.
Ginger beer,
street sellers, beggars, musicians, drunkards, workers, shoppers, and of course, lots of horse traffic.
I'll buy you rope, steer rods, locks, keys...
Petticoat Lane bursts with extraordinary sights, sounds, and smells. Canny salesmen push cheap garments, imitation jewellery, and dubious medicines. They crowd the street, and the path between them is narrow.
Oh, I can't give you 16 shillings. I've got my rent to pay.
Some stalls offer a medley of bric-a-brac.
Madam, looks like you'd go through a fire for a bargain.
Furniture covers, old clothes, worn-out boots and rusty locks. Buyers plan to renovate their items and sell them on again. There is a flourishing trade in second-hand clothing.
Better and wear better than anything you've bought before.
When the rent is due or when someone hasn't eaten for a while, a lady's bonnet or a man's shirt can be turned over to a dealer or a pawnbroker for ready cash. Over there is Annie Chapman, that tired and weak soul with a terrible cough. She's contracted tuberculosis. Annie is counting the days until Saturday. That's when her partner, Ted Stanley, comes and meets her, takes her to the pub, and spends the weekend with her at a local lodging house. Annie has bought herself a cheap ring to wear in place of a wedding band. Even here, in Whitechapel, she is worried about appearances. Not that long ago, Annie led an entirely different life. She owned pretty earrings, brooches, and a real wedding ring. She even lived on a country estate in the shadow of Windsor Castle, Queen Victoria's residence. Her story, her tumble from comfort and 19th-century respectability, is an astonishing and poignant one. But she rarely reveals the truth of her past life to anyone around here. The woman they call Dark Annie leans against a wall, watching the hubbub. Traders hawk fruits and vegetables, breads and cakes. Customers haggle over fish. This part of London is home to a huge immigrant community. Jewish refugees fleeing the murderous pogroms of Russia and Eastern Europe have flocked here. Yiddish is spoken on the streets and floats from the theatres and music halls that cater to the newcomers. But we're just passing through the market and down this side street. It's slick with sewage and pools of stagnant water. In certain places, the stench of rot and refuse is pungent and nauseating. Trash gathers in the corners near dwellings. Human waste, horse droppings, worthless scraps, and things broken beyond use are scattered about. Nothing of any value, no matter how minute, is ever thrown away. There is always someone who will repurpose it, fix it, or sell it on. People have many ways of surviving here. And here's our destination. This common lodging house is a bleak and grimy establishment.
Common lodging houses got going in the early 1850s in order to cater for very poor people who could no longer even afford a weekly rent in a room of their own.
That's social historian Sarah Wise.
Now, these common lodging houses were totally private concerns, but they had, by law, to be inspected by the Metropolitan Police. The stipulation was a common lodging house was somewhere in which three or more persons not of the same family may sleep within the same dormitory. So it's the idea that, yes, we're mixing loads of people together with all the potential moral dangers that could involve, but that's okay because all the beds are separated. We've got a superintendent on site, so no hanky-panky gets going. And, of course, the police can inspect.
Common lodging houses aren't supposed to admit anyone of known bad character. Drunkenness and other forms of vice, like adultery, aren't supposed to flourish here. But in practice, many turn a blind eye. They're not too fussed about bad character, and they do admit drunks. In fact, the conditions at a lodging house are as good or as bad as the person who runs it. And this lodging house is home to an awful lot of vice. At the entrance sits the deputy lodging house keeper, or manager. Before nightfall, he collects fourpence from everyone who intends to use the dormitory upstairs. That would be less than about $10 today. Fourpence buys a coffin bed, a person-sized box, likely hopping with fleas, in which to lie down. The room is noisy, dirty, and stifling, but it's better than the street. And down this passage is another room. This kitchen is 30 feet long and packed full of people. An older woman dozes to one side with a filthy child playing at her feet.
Once in the dear dead days beyond recall.
It smells like old grease, beer, stale tobacco smoke, and the sharp oniony scent of sweaty, unwashed bodies. Just over there is Kate Eddowes with her partner, John Kelly. Kate's the one singing. Kate has spent much of her life doing this, though usually she's selling sheet music when she's belting out a tune. Everyone who knows her, from her sisters to her friends at the lodging house, remark on her jolly personality.
Just a song at twilight, when the lights are low and the flickering shadows softly come and go.
However, drink can turn her high-spiritedness into aggression. Kate fascinates me. She's a rebel, and she was born to a rebel. Her father was a union agitator, so perhaps it was he who taught her to rail against the system. She rejected the conventional existence of her mother, grandmother, and sisters, life constantly giving birth, scrubbing and cooking, and instead chose the open road. She's lived for many years as a vagrant. Kate's story is about the lack of choices available to women, and how class and gender kept them in poverty.
He lost his shop and in a while killed his
A group of men, all of them drunk, are crowded there by the range, quaffing beer. This is a common sight. Many of the people here are bereaved, lonely and homeless, and they drown their sorrows.
Well, when a man's lost his place, he may as well go the old lot, bristles and all.
Some commotion is breaking out in one corner.
Hey.
It's two women, arguing over a bar of soap.
Give me that.
This is a precious commodity.
You stole that right out of my pocket. Get off me!
But there's also conviviality in this kitchen. The cooking range, the focus of the room, burns all day, and it bathes the space around it in warmth. This is a blessing. Even in the summer, London days can be chilly.
Everybody convened down in the great big common kitchen. You would buy your food out in the street, maybe from a costermonger. Maybe you get a saveloy or some fish, maybe some bacon or a jacket potato. And you use the range of the common stove to cook your food, and you eat it in the kitchen with everyone around you. And we've got plenty of eyewitness accounts of just what kind of quite convivial places these could be. Card games, all sorts of board games going on, people laughing, joking, reading the newspaper in a corner, and this human warmth and human noise and company and chat. I wouldn't underestimate the value of that in some broken lives.
This lodging house is the haunt of beggars, criminals, women selling sex, chronic alcoholics, the unemployed, the sick, the old. But there are people here from other walks of life too. Some of these lodging house residents entered the world in entirely different circumstances.
We do hear of members of the aristocracy who have drunk their inheritance or gambled it away. Maybe being an aristocrat wasn't what they wanted. So a much bigger mix than many people would have thought living in your common lodging house.
Today, the 6th of August, I'm looking for a particular face in this kitchen. A local woman named Martha Tabram. Martha's around 40, and like most of the women who live here, her hard life has taken its toll. Her marriage has soured, as have other partnerships with men. In a few hours, Martha's story will end in her murder. As evening draws in, the atmosphere in the kitchen starts to change. Desperation increases. The deputy lodging housekeeper has started turning out those who haven't paid for a bed that night.
Lock him, order. Whoa, that's it.
Outside, a police constable is on patrol. Whoa. Fights often break out when lodging houses close their doors for the evening. Today is a public holiday, so some locals have indulged in more drink than usual. This officer is ready and waiting to arrest any troublemakers.
Come on, you pigeon-livered ratbag! Mug him back!
The men of the local police force, H Division, will soon be pitched into a difficult and desperate hunt to find Jack the Ripper and end the horrific killings. What they do, what they say, and what they decide to enter into the historical record will set the tone for how the murdered women are remembered well into the 21st century. So let's learn a bit about them and follow this police constable back to headquarters. The Ripper Retold will be back in just a moment. Welcome to Leman Street Police Station, home to H Division of the Metropolitan Police. H Division comprises about 500 officers, pounding their beats in a labyrinth of dark city streets from the wharves and docks on the River Thames up to the gasworks and filthy canals of Haggerston. In between are some of the most deprived neighbourhoods in the capital, plenty of dark blues and blacks on Charles Booth's poverty map. Nine. Inside is the kind of commotion you might expect of a busy police station. We know from the records that there's a steady flow of arrests and that the holding cells are filling up. John Hawkins has been brought in for assaulting his wife, and 19-year-old Joseph Gibson is under arrest, charged with indecent exposure. I'm interested in one police officer in particular, Thomas Barrett. He's about to start a night shift, and he's going to play a significant role in Martha Tabram's story. We know from police records that Thomas is 5'10". This is tall by Victorian standards. He's also just moved to London from idyllic rural Dorset. Whitechapel has surely been a shock to the system. He himself lives outside the neighbourhood, for Whitechapel isn't considered a fitting address for such an upstanding young man. Thomas is getting ready to walk his regular beat. He carries an oil lantern swinging from his belt, which he'll use to peer into Whitechapel's dark corners, and there are many of those. He also has a pair of handcuffs with him, and a whistle, this is a relatively new piece of technology, allowing him to cut through the din of the Whitechapel streets and summon help if he needs it. It's a useful tool. As he patrols, he'll meet with all kinds of crimes and misdemeanors, from alcohol-fueled fights to robberies, stabbings, and domestic violence. He'll also confront social care issues. When the police encounter drunkards who are so inebriated that they can no longer walk, they arrest them and bring them in.
He lined his ass with broken glass and circumcised a skimmer!
Take local woman Margaret Kane. By the start of this year, she had been charged with drunken disorderliness over 200 times. Sometimes she challenges the policeman outside the station. On other occasions, she just hands herself in. The recruitment criteria to join the force are strict. Officers must be able to read and write. They also must be over a certain height, aged between 21 and 35, and come with a reference that shows their good, respectable character. But whatever you might have gathered from Sherlock Holmes stories, the detection skills of these officers are limited. They rely on eyewitnesses, confessions, and catching culprits red-handed. We're back out on the street, and it's dark. Let's follow Constable Barrett on his beat.
What about the Angel and Crown for a drink?
We pass off-duty soldiers stationed at the nearby Tower of London.
I rather fancy the 10 bells, Miss.
We're turning onto Whitechapel Road, the busiest and widest thoroughfare in the area. It's lined with pubs, one seemingly every few yards. Here the hopeless drown their sorrows in rot-gut gin. But they are also the closest thing many local people have to a parlour or a living room. Here, people can meet, talk, play games and sing together, all in the warm amber glow of gaslight. Some pubs are even opulent, with carved wooden panelling and decorative mirrors.
I'll have a dog's nose myself. That's half a pint of ale with a pennyworth of gin.
The Angel and Crown on Goulston Street is not such
a
place.
It's
150 years old. And it shows. This pub's interior has been worn by the years and by the rough company that congregates here.
Will you take something, miss?
Martha Tabram has been here this evening with a friend and two soldiers who would have been paying for their drinks. In the Victorian era, this was expected of men, no matter their social background. Martha, like so many Whitechapel inhabitants, likes a tipple. But it's possible that an edge of desperation crept in on her enjoyment as the hours wore on this evening. Martha would have woken this morning not knowing where she would be sleeping come nightfall. When the pub closes, she'll be worried about scraping together the 4 pence to return to her lodging house. Will she be able to afford it, or will she have to sleep on the street with all the dangers this brings? Constable Barrett continues his beat. Leaving the main street, we are entering darker, narrower alleys and passages. This lack of light is oppressive and menacing. We slide and skid on who knows what. A figure appears ahead of us, a man. Barrett's lamp illuminates a soldier in uniform. The constable challenges him. What is he doing loitering here at this time?
Waiting for a chum who went off with a girl,
comes the reply. Not an unusual answer, perhaps, and so the beat continues, hour after hour, with no rest. We are passing Miller's Court now. There, in the broken window of number 13, a light flickers. Mary Jane Kelly, a sex worker, rents this one-room abode with her partner, Joseph Barnett, who has only recently lost his job at Billingsgate Fish Market. This was their only source of income, and Barnett is too proud to let his girlfriend solicit on the streets again. Their worries will grow in the coming weeks, before Mary Jane becomes a victim of the Ripper. Mary Jane's life is a puzzle for anyone attempting to unravel the stories and half-truths that make up her existence. She once sold sex in the rich West End of London, and moved in much higher circles, wearing nice dresses and travelling in carriages between restaurants and hotels. What on earth happened to land her here, in a furnished room, in a yard across from a block of stinking latrines? But that will be for later.
Now, as the first glow of morning breaks the eastern sky and as workers begin to rise from their beds, there are other matters to return to.
Help! Police!
We are back in George Yard.
Help!
A woman's body has been found. The wide pool of blood around it has already begun to thicken and dry. Her clothes are in disarray. It seems hopeless, but Constable Barrett sends for medical assistance. Martha Tabram has been dead for several hours, says Dr. Killeen. He counts 39 stab wounds. When the catalogue of injuries is later read out to the coroner at court, he says it is the most dreadful crime anyone can imagine and declares that the murderer must be a savage. He urges the officers of H Division to find the culprit. Constable Barrett is sent to track down the soldier he'd seen at about the time of Martha's death, but he has no luck. The other soldiers he interviews close ranks, offering up alibis for each other and frustrating Barrett's investigation. With hindsight, the viciousness of Martha's unsolved murder will cause some people to conclude that her death was the work of Jack the Ripper. Rightly or wrongly, Martha's death doesn't feature in the conventional telling of the famous Ripper story. Her murder, along with the killings of 10 other women between April 1888 and February 1891, are referred to collectively as the Whitechapel murders. Those women were Emma Elizabeth Smith, Polly Nichols, Annie Chapman, Elizabeth Stride, Catherine Eddowes, Mary Jane Kelly, Rose Milet, Alice Mackenzie, Frances Coles, and the torso of an anonymous woman found under a railway arch. At the time, and even today, there is debate about whether all of these women were victims of the same killer. Eventually, the consensus among the police would be that due to the similarity of the weapon used and the nature of the injuries, only Polly, Annie, Elizabeth, Catherine, and Mary Jane could be identified as Ripper victims. Martha's death, as well as the murders of those who followed, whether by the hands of Jack the Ripper or some other malefactor, only served to illustrate just how normal deadly violence against women was in 19th century Whitechapel, and how the killers so often escaped justice. I often get asked why I didn't include Martha Tabram among the Ripper victims, or why I didn't write a book called The Eleven. But writing a book about Jack the Ripper, obsessing over the minutiae of injuries and murder weapons, was never my objective. I wanted to study life, not the agonizing, terror-filled moments of death, and the Five offered me a perfect data set. The experiences of Polly, Annie, Elizabeth, Kate, and Mary Jane were quite simply the experiences of millions of Victorian women. They fell in love, endured childbirth and the deaths of parents. They argued with their siblings, they wept, they dreamed, they hurt, and they enjoyed small triumphs. The courses of their lives mirrored that of so many others, and yet their lives were so singular in the ways they ended. Jack the Ripper will never be caught, but justice can be restored when we remember their names and learn their stories. They don't need to be forgotten or to remain silent any longer. So please, come with me. I can't wait to introduce you to them. Bad Women, the Ripper Retold is brought to you by Pushkin Industries and me, Hallie Rubenhold, and is based on my book, The Five. It was produced and co-written by Ryan Dilly and Alice Fiennes, with help from Pete Norton. Pascal Wise sound designed and mixed the show and composed all the original music. You also heard the voice talents of Saul Boyer, Melanie Guttridge, Gemma Saunders, and Rufus Wright. The show also wouldn't have been possible without the work of Mia LaBelle, Jacob Weisberg, Jen Guerra, Heather Fain, Carly Migliori, Maggie Taylor, Nicole Morano, and Daniela Lacan. With special thanks to my agents, Sarah Ballard and Ellie Caron.